The Ray D'Arcy Show on RTE Radio 1. Proudly sponsored by Volkswagen. Volkswagen.ie.
Good afternoon on this Friday afternoon. How are you? 51551 for your texts. If you want to contact us via email, it's ray@rte.ie. News just in. Marion Keyes has changed her Twitter handle in a tribute to Steve Coogan's alter ego, Martin Brennan. Now, if you didn't see this yet, I don't know where you've been all week, but This Life, which is a sort of a programme that takes the mickey out of daytime programming, it's Steve Coogan at his best, his alter ego, Alan Partridge. And on Monday evening, Alan Partridge had an Alan Partridge lookalike from the west of Ireland called Martin Brennan on. And I'll play a bit. I'll play a bit again. But anyway, his thing was, when he was told that he looked like Alan Partridge, he responded, "Who the hell is that? Who the hell is that?" And this is what Marion Keyes has renamed her Twitter handle. I said, "Who the hell is that?" To put it in context, in case you think I'm talking gobbledygook, here's a clip, an audio clip from This Life, Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge, Martin Brennan, Monday night.
"Who the hell is that?"
See? Yeah, he said that.
"Who the hell is that?"
And then he went on to sing Sweet 16 and Come Out You Black and Tans and The Men Behind the Wire, and people have been talking about it ever since. And the clips are up there. The clips are up there. Unfortunately, I don't know when this is going to change. We can't watch the whole programme back unless you recorded it. They don't let us. The BBC don't let us over here. Geo-blocking is what they call it. Geo-blocking. They can do that. They can decide that people in certain countries can't watch their programmes. So geo-blocking, just so you know, that's a word for the weekend for you. So Marion Keyes, in awe of Steve Coogan and changing her Twitter handle to
"Who the hell is that?"
it was just brilliant. Barbara Streisand.
"Who the hell is that?"
Sorry. You know who Barbara Streisand is. She's 76 and she's a singer, actor, and she's given an amusing enough interview to the London Times. She's going on tour again. She says in the interview how she contacted Tim Cook, who is the Apple CEO, to ask them to change the way that Siri pronounces her name. It should be Streisand, Barbara Streisand. Now, I said Streisand last week in the company of Richard E. Grant, who's a big fan of herself, and he corrected me. He says it's Streisand, not Streisand, Streisand. So there. She also reveals that she has cloned her dog. It was a Cotton de Tulier. I hope I pronounced that correctly. And her name is Samantha. And she is quoted in the article saying, "I couldn't bear losing her. I think any pet owner will understand this. I had to continue her DNA. There were no more curly hair cottons like Samantha. She was very rare. In order to get another one, I had to clone her." So the DNA was taken from Samantha. And now Barbara Streisand has two replicas, Violet and Scarlet. That all started with Dolly the Sheep. And of course, it's only a matter of time before, they're probably doing it already in some laboratory somewhere, some evil lair. They're probably cloning humans, but they can do it for dogs and animals. So it's only a matter of time, only a matter of time. We were talking quizzes yesterday and Quicksilver came in for a lot of mentions and people were saying, "Bring it back, bring Quicksilver back." And Alfie Dehan got onto us. He says, "Hope all is well with you and your staff and the great city of Dublin." We're not exactly in the city, Alfie. We're about, what, 3 or 4 miles outside the city centre. "Listen to your radio show today. I heard you discuss the different quiz programmes on RTE down through the years, and Quicksilver came up for a few mentions, hence the reason for me contacting you. In 1971 or 1972, not sure, because it was so long ago, myself and a good friend of mine decided to go to RTE in the hope of getting on Quicksilver. We were lucky. We got in no problem. And yes, I ended up in front of the great Bunny Carr. I was getting on very well until Bunny asked me, 'What is the largest lake in the world?' My answer was, 'The Caspian Sea.' Bunny said, 'Not correct. It's Lake Michigan.' In a nice way, I disputed this by saying what I'd learnt in school in geography classes. Loch Ness is the largest lake in Europe, with the exception of Lake Ladoga and Onega, or it could be Onega in Russia, Lake Vänern in Sweden and Lake Geneva in Switzerland, and the Caspian Sea, the largest lake in the world. This is what I'd learned in geography, but Bunny stuck to his guns. Also, at the end of the show, there was a 3 or 4 part question to identify a popular person at the time. This was open to all 4 on the panel. the four people who'd taken part in Quicksilver that evening. First clue was, he is a member of Fianna Fáil. No one got it. Next clue was, he's from Galway. I pressed the button. Minister Seamus Brennan, I said. Correct, said Bunny. So I came out okay at the end. And a nice twist to the story is 2 weeks later, I got a letter with a cheque to say I was correct regarding my answer, the Caspian Sea. That made my day, but Bunny never corrected it on air, to my disappointment. So perhaps 47 years later, you might do it. You might correct it on air. Well, to whom it may concern, Alfie Dean answered a question back in 1971-72 on Quicksilver. When asked, what is the largest lake in the world, he said the Caspian Sea. Although the presenter, the late Bonnie Carr, said he was incorrect, he was in fact correct. And we're happy to put the record straight. 48 or 49 years on. So there you go, Alfie. Hope that's sorted it for you. Quizzes are dangerous things. You know, it's difficult. I remember over the years in Blackboard Jungle, we'd a number of controversial decisions. I think one of them was even in the final, if memory serves me correctly. And there was a cheque written as well. And then there was another one where something went wrong and we had to re-record the whole programme. And it went on and on and on. I remember one morning, there was a question about table tennis. And a man in the audience who was a teacher or a parent stuck up his hand and disputed the answer, as you did with Bunny, Alfie. And we rang the Irish Table Tennis Association. As you can imagine, there was no, you know, permanent officer. So we had to wait for somebody to answer the phone. And we waited and we waited. And we all sat there in the studio for about an hour and a half till somebody from the Irish Table Tennis Association answered the phone and put us straight. I think we were right and the person in the audience was wrong. And the Caspian Sea, yes, it is. It's mentioned as a lake in a lot of places. So Alfie was right. We read out a letter from May yesterday about loneliness. May is 60 plus and she lives in a rural area and in a little estate, and everybody sort of empties out of the estate in the morning, including her husband. And then when people come back in, they're too busy with their own families to mix. And she says she feels really lonely. We got loads of suggestions and I didn't get to them yesterday. Just a few of them. Somebody suggesting she could mind dogs for people. That's not a bad idea. If you become a dog walker, that's Mary in Clontarf. Of course, the assumption is that May likes dogs. Somebody else says she could volunteer for the Irish Girl Guides. Other people suggested dance troops, a number of that. The ICA came up as a suggestion. Active retirement groups. Bridge, says somebody else. And if the person has a car, she can drive to loads of different places. Libraries are great because the book clubs, knitting clubs, choir, etc. They are a super facility, heated, comfortable, access to books, newspaper, computers. Also, I would suggest she volunteer as a helper in some area, Vincent de Paul, or whatever. That's Nina. And I'm reading a lot of research at the moment, and books and everything. And volunteering hugely enhances your life. And it improves your outcomes health-wise, just physical health and mental health. It's a big plus if that's what you know, if you're in the market for volunteering and you have the time, it will enhance your life. So that's it. So thanks for all of those. Tomorrow night on the telly, there's a great lineup actually. Tomorrow night on the telly, we're on quite late, 10:20. So hopefully you'll stay up for us. We've Stephen Travers, and Stephen Travers was a member of the Miami Show Band back in the day, and he was one of the survivors, although he calls himself a victim now, of the Miami Show Band massacre. And tonight, if you're subscribing to Netflix, you'll be able to watch a documentary about the whole Miami Show Band massacre back in 1975. And Stephen's going to come on and tell us his story about the massacre and then what he's done since and his search for truth. And it's an amazing story. So he's going to be on with us. So too is PJ Gallagher, Joanna Reardon, who's always a good chat. We have Anne Hegarty, who's the governess from The Chase, and she was on I'm a Celebrity as well. And Camille O'Sullivan and her partner in life, Aidan Gillen, are getting together to sing a song, first time ever on the telly. Because they're going to be performing at Rock for Homelessness in a few weeks. So they're coming on to give us an exclusive of that tomorrow. So that's tomorrow night on the telly, 10:20. That voice sounds like Mick Clifford.
Who the hell is that?
I know he's a journalist with The Examiner. He wrote that great book about Maurice McCabe. That's Mick Clifford. Tell that lady to join a gym. I'm a gym owner and see so many people form friendships in the gym. And bring back Mike Murphy for a quiz. Yeah, I don't know if he's up for it. The last time we had him in here, he sounded very happy not to be here, if you know what I mean. She could swim each morning. Well, she's rural and, you know, swimming pools aren't all over the place. And I'm a Sky customer and sometimes listen to your show on TV, on digital radio, on channel 0160, but occasionally accidentally get the channel next to yours, channel 0151. It's a radio station called Koosh Kabri. The station is an Indian station, totally unlistable, whiny music. Why is this? You would imagine the station nearest to an Irish station would be BBC or a Scottish station or a French station. What I wonder is this, is it the same situation in far off India? Is some poor fella or woman in Mumbai or Kathmandu getting RTE accidentally, mumbling to themselves? What the? Who the?
Who the hell is that?
That's what they're probably saying. Yeah, as you probably know, this means who the hell is Ray Darcy? Yes, I do. Yes, yeah. That's Chow. That's Frank in Kildare. Let me see what else is there. You might have put the record straight for Alfie, but is RTE going to pay him the shilling it owes him? No, he got the check. That was the thing. That was the twist. He got the check and an apology in the post, but he never got an on-air recognition that he'd answered the question correctly. And that was his gripe that he was holding on to for 47 years. I wonder, did Alfie ever tell that story before? Yeah. The largest lake, what answer did Bunny Carr think was correct? Lake Michigan, he said. If Barbara Streisand is 76, the dog will probably live longer than her, says that person. Streisand, I'll have to rehearse that in case I ever get to meet her. I remember you in a Blackboard Jungle final asking which World War was the Battle of Flanders. They answered World War II and won the minibus. It was, of course, World War I. Brian and Ennis, it's funny you should say that because I think that was the question that caused the hassle and there was a check involved. So that's mad that you spotted that. Well done, Brian and Ennis. I didn't set the questions, mind you, Brian. 51551 ray@rte.ie. Good afternoon. Miley Cyrus and Mark Ronson, and Nothing Breaks Like a Heart. She's going back to her country roots. Of course, her dad is Billy Ray Cyrus. And when you listen to that, you can't help but think of... Go on.
Jolene.
But she's a great voice, Miley Cyrus. And remember, Lynn Anderson as well, Rose Garden. Very similar. It's brilliant. Mark Ronson was the man who sort of did it for Amy Winehouse. He's a producer. Very talented man. Genius, some would say. So that's Nothing Breaks Like a Heart. Miley Cyrus on RT Radio 1. 51551 for your text. You can send us emails to ray@rte.ie. Broadcaster, writer, comedian, Colm O'Regan. He's guiding us through the soundtrack to his life today. We have live music from Mick Flannery. And... we're going to get Finbar Fury's opinion on Steve Coogan, Alan Partridge, Martin Brennan singing Sweet 16. That's coming up in a moment. But first, the absolute last thing that lonely ladies should do is join a gym. Gym going is generally a solitary activity. I've been going to the gym for years and never met a single new friend there, says Garrett. And have you heard the expression helpers high? I haven't. In relation to the benefits of volunteers if you do it. One suggestion is her local Meals on Wheels. You can do 1 or 2 days and the people you meet enjoy meeting you. I'd personally recommend it, but the lady would need to have a car. Obviously, it's Margaret in Cork. And as a quizmaster compiler, I have come across the problem with world's largest lake. Apparently, Lake Michigan is largest by volume, i.e. most water, but Caspian Sea is largest by area. Oh, it's a question setter's nightmare. Tom, give us a few questions there. We want to try and challenge Anne Hegarty tomorrow night. Throw a few questions at me that she may not be able to answer, because she does. That's what she does on The Chase, isn't it? The governess is there and then the people have to try and beat her, but she knows everything. And usually the governess, whoever it might be, will win. So give us a few questions there, Tom and Mayo, 51551. Finbar Fury after this.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
51551. Good afternoon, Finbar Fury.
Good afternoon, Ray.
Good to talk to you.
You too.
nice to hear your voice.
Yeah, we play in that clip. So this is from the end of this time. This time on Monday night, Steve Coogan playing Alan Partridge, and sitting in front of him is an Alan Partridge lookalike called Martin Brennan from the west of Ireland. And this is what happens at the end of the interview.
Well, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for tonight.
No, we could let you go without a little song.
Well,
no.
Thank you anyway, but we've got a great montage of police dogs set to music.
We do indeed, yeah.
I love you as I never loved before.
You're going to ruin a slow-mo sequence of Alsatians jumping up and biting the arms of dog handlers set to Hungry Like the Wolf by Duran Duran. It's great TV.
Come on, lads, come on. Come to me.
Please stop playing.
Or my dream of love is o'er. I love you as I loved you when you were sweet. When you were sweet. 16.
He does a good job, doesn't he, Fimber?
He's got that Mayo touch on him, all right, you know. He's that gas. I watch his programme and I absolutely clap. It cracks me up laughing, you know. I've been watching it for a long time on the TV, you know, the Alan Partridge show. It's very funny, you know.
When did that come onto your radar?
I haven't a clue. We were in Birmingham on St. Patrick's Day. We flew over on Saturday and hooked up with some great friends that I hadn't seen for ages and ages, you know. So we had the night out with them and then St. Paddy's morning. So we went to the parade. And it was great because the sun shone for a good while.
Mm.
And then I did a concert then from 4 o'clock, from 3 o'clock to 4:30. And then went back on like you would at the end of the evening. And it was a great day. I can't describe it to you, you know.
Right.
It was cold now, you know, really. Yeah. The stage was very cold. You had to face it right into the wind. So, like, I had a great time. A Sweet 16 could be heard all over Birmingham. Trust me, he probably heard it. I don't know where he got it from. But I tell you, he does a great job. His voice sounds brilliant on it. When I heard it first, I said, hang on, who's that? That's me.
Yeah, you know? He's obviously been listening to your records.
I definitely, you know. And I was amazed and blown away, actually, because I just saw him in the Laurel and Hardy movie. He played Stan Laurel. It was fantastic, you know. He reminds me a bit of Dermot Morgan, actually. He's got shades of Dermot, you know, in the beginnings, you know, when Dermot used to do the Late Late Show, he'd do mad things. I remember him taking me on, you know, copying me singing the Greenfields of France,
did
you
he?
Know, and he copied Ronnie Drew and a few more.
Yeah.
And it was the funniest thing I ever saw in my life. And when I saw Alan Partridge singing it, I just cracked up laughing. And I thought to myself, you know, it's such a lovely song. It's probably getting to him as well when you hear the little grace notes coming in, you know. I like that.
Yeah. And so, if we ever get a chance to ask him, we'll ask him, did he listen to you for inspiration? But I've no doubt that he didn't even close the eyes. Would you do a duet with him? You know, you've been known to do the odd duet.
I'd love to meet him.
Yeah,
of course. You know, he's a wonderful entertainer. He's an amazing comedian, you know.
Yeah.
And I love that dry sense of humour, you know. You know, he's got that very sort of upper, stiffer class, you know,
yeah.
But not actually fully there, you know.
Yeah.
You know, he's sort of a marble missing, you know.
Yes, he has notions above a station, as they say.
And like, I'd say he's like that in reality too, but he sounds like a very clever guy. Yeah, no problem. But he's such a nice fella anyway. No problem. I've seen his mass from Mayo.
That's it. He used to holiday in Mayo and West Cork when he was when he was younger.
That's great. You know.
Remind me about that song and you.
I got the song originally. Mayo had the words were written in a book. My father, Lord Wilson, in an old song book years ago, and he'd written it out. You know, and he used to sing it now and again. And I remember all the old buskers years ago. You know.
Mm.
When they'd be called to Puck Fair and places like that. And there wouldn't be a dry eye in the house, you know. Somebody would sing it somewhere around the place, around the town, you know. And, like, it was always around the campfire at night, you know, and somebody would open up with it. And there was an old accordion player years ago. He was called the Dreamer Wilson. And he was a busker, you know. And he used to come up to the session, if you like, at the end of the evening. And he'd sit down and have his bottle of stout. And he'd sing Beautiful Dreamer. and Sweet 16 and do all of these beautiful old ballads, you know. As well, John McCormick won a Fesh Cole with it, with the same song when he was only 12. So, I mean, you check into that. You know, so my mother reckons the song come from pre-famine or just after the famine, you know. And it definitely came from Ireland, she said. A lot of our songs, like, were taken, to America. And, of course, there was no publishing in them days, so people just took them, you know, and put their names to them, you know.
And, of course...
And, when my father died, right, 1979... I used to stay in the house most of the time with my ma when I'd be up in Ballyfermot. I'd always hang out and, you know, bring the lads. We'd all, you know, stay with her because it's a sad time for her. And I remember one day just messing around the house, just helping her around the house, and I was humming, actually, Sweet 16, and she said to me, you should sing that song sometime, you know. It's a really beautiful song. And it's a very old song. And your father loved it as well, so... I said, I just had a look around, but the words are upstairs in his book. So up I went, and, you know, I hadn't played the banjo since I played with Eddie in Germany years ago, you know, when we were a duet at the time, just the two of us. And before that, I played with the Clancy Brothers for 3 years on stage with them, you know, around the States. So I blew the dust off the five string and wrote the banjo piece because it was only one verse and one chorus. It was too short, you know, so I had to lengthen it. So what I did, I lengthened it with the banjo solo, which actually sat on it so lovely. Yeah, and everybody, like, I remember meeting Glenn Campbell, Lord of Merchant, when he came to Seamshire Coastley years ago, and he was blown away with the banjo piece, you know, and just the song itself, and in the end, I think he recorded it as well. So, I mean, Perry Como has recorded it, you know, Al Jolson recorded it. I mean, it's one of these amazing songs that just go straight back, you know.
But yours is the definitive version.
You know, before that, you know, there was sort of Harry Lauder threw a verse into it, which didn't really, for me, it didn't suit it, you know. I like the original anyway. And my mother always said it was originally probably came from around Tipperary town. Yeah. She always said Tip for some reason, you know.
Yeah.
I asked her, where do you think? Oh, she said, I'd say around Tipperary town. Well, that could be because her mother came from Tip anyway, you know. But it's one of these songs that belongs to all of us, you know.
And Finbar, do you reckon listening to Steve Coogan sing it there as Martin Brennan, definitely that's your version, is it? Or is it?
I wouldn't say it's my version. I'd say he's definitely listening to the album.
Right, which is your version.
I do a different version.
Yeah. Can't wait to see Finbar in Ballykeith Amphitheatre in the summer. Amazing artisan venue. Will be brilliant. What a legend.
Thanks, Ray.
And I painted a portrait of Finbar and I was wondering if I might leave it somewhere for him to collect. I don't have an address for him. Well, they can get into us here and we'll
look up Most Wanted.
That's where he got the photo from, yeah.
Passport division.
Yeah, you're in Vicar Street next week, Wednesday 27 and Thursday 28.
Yeah, looking forward to it.
Yeah. Somebody wants to know, you have acted in the past, haven't you? Have you done a bit of acting?
Yeah, I just got a little script in from, it's a film that they haven't got the money to make it yet, but they're nearly there. It's a film that they're doing in Carmel in California called Caller. And they want me to write a couple of pieces of music for it. And Judy Collins has just hooked up for it, and there's a few more. I'm looking forward to that, you know. Okay. I played a part of the schoolmaster, or a school teacher, if you like. And it's in the 20s. It's about, it was written by this guy called Robertson Jeffers. He was an environmentalist that lived in the 20s. He once said about, he was against America going into the Second World War. He sort of argued with Roosevelt and all of that. He was one of these amazing characters. And he once said that a bunch of wildflowers were more nobler than the human race.
Right.
You know, at that time, you know, because of all the war that was going on, you know, and politics. And so he left behind him this amazing collection of poetry. He once came to Ireland as well and met up with Yeats and hung out with Yeats for a while. So this young kid over there bought up all his stuff, you know, all his poetry and all his wonderful writings. And he's just dug into one of his poems, and so he wants to create a movie out of one of his poems.
Nice.
It'll be a bit like, it's a bit on the, if you like, it's about an Indian tribe, the Mescaleros. And, you know, they're trying to make a tribe of their own because their own, you know, like they're across, they're a different breed, you know, of Indian. It's very complicated.
Okay,
very
and you're political. That's exciting, isn't it? That's exciting.
Yeah, so yeah. I'll be out there for about a month. I've only got a little part in it, really, but it's like the school teacher, the Irish schoolmaster. And the nice thing about it is, like, I left early because I was an Irish rebel, you know, at the time, so yeah. I had to get out, you know.
So
the only thing I really know about is revolution, you know.
Yeah.
So I'm teaching all these Red right. Indians about revolution. That'll be a funny one.
Right. Listen, Finberg.
For a crack anyway.
Good talking to you.
You too.
As always.
God bless you.
Yeah,
care.
Yeah, you too. Bye.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or ray@rte.ie. Now, every Friday we invite somebody in to guide us through the soundtrack to their life. And today it's the turn of comedian, broadcaster, novelist Colm O'Regan. Good afternoon, Colm.
Thank you for having me.
I'm novelist.
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 I've graduated. I have a degree now in books. From the College of Books.
That's a novel part of your introduction.
Exactly. Yeah, new and novel.
New and novel, yeah. Anne Devine, ready for a close-up. The first thing, I read a good few pages of it last night. So you are writing as a woman.
That's right, yeah.
Now, explain, is that difficult and does it often happen?
Well, I'm sure I'm not the first novelist.
No, I know Donal Ryan did it in one of his, yeah.
It's hard, it's a challenge and it's fun at the same time to try and forget what you're, you know, because we all have these internal biases and you imagine this is how other people think, you know. And it's not like she was there, you know, watching loads of episodes of Top Gear and subscribing to Shoot magazine, but there are subtle little things that you realise, actually, no, that's me that would do that or that would say that. So I feel like she's an assemblage of all the little things I've overheard or the looks or the glances. I kind of describe it as listening into one side of a telephone conversation and imagining the other side. So it's about filling in gaps and taking a punt on what somebody might think, somebody who is different to you, somebody's older, a different gender in a different situation. And thankfully, based on what people have said
the
so
reaction,
far,
yes.
That's my Auntie Mary. That's my mam. You know,
and she lives in Kilsudgeon.
Kilsudgeon, yeah.
Yes. Which is any small town.
It's county anywhere.
Yes.
And the great thing about Irish place names is that they could literally have any, they could be spelled anyway or have any sound because of transliteration of the way, you know, the way the English wrote down our names long ago. Because we have places in Ireland like Tang and Tempo.
Yeah.
And
Gagan.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have Lyra Campan and Neil Willa and every single combination. So Kilsudgeon in the fictional backstory is the Church of St. Udgen.
Right.
I haven't decided if he's a Norman saint or whether he's like one of these pagan saints who was once a frog and then changed to Christian, you know, mysteriously in the 6th century.
And she's an active member of the Tidy Towns Committee.
As it comes about in the book, she's wouldn't have described herself as, in inverted commas, prominent locally at the start of the book. She would have been somebody who keeps herself to herself, is a confidant, is known well enough, but wouldn't be putting herself forward. And she gets volunteered to be on the Tidy Towns Committee by her daughter in the way that often adult children will try and direct their own parents' lives. Her daughter thinks, because Anne's youngest son is gone to college, that Anne needs something to keep her busy or she'll go mad.
Yes.
So she volunteers her in a well-meaning gesture that has hopefully a cascade of consequences.
What genre is it in? Comedy? Comic fiction.
And
it's Anne Devine, ready for a close-up. Not all heroes wear capes, some wear a high-vis.
That's right. It's a tribute to the people of the high-vis, the original people of the high-vis, not the more recent ones.
I used to be on a local committee back
were
in
you?
The day, yes, yeah, yeah.
And can you remember that feeling of
one of the big discussion points at the time was a mural.
A
mural.
Yeah.
And then we spent two meetings discussing whether we should have melon and parma ham or a prawn cocktail for the starter.
For the starter.
Launch.
I thought it was for the mural. I can imagine exactly how committee meetings go, because there are, at any committee there are people who just love attending meetings, and then there are another group of people who have somewhere else to be. Yeah. And a meeting, a classic meeting, is the tension between those, because who hasn't been at a meeting where the issue is starters, but at some point somebody will say, and there was a van going around, yes, and we don't know who he was. Now, he was supposed to be picking up scrap metal, but I don't think now. So the next thing the guards are called, and a squad car appears in the story, and before long, again, nobody has picked the Parmesan, yes, or the mozzarella, or
it was
melon.
A prawn cocktail, or the melon and ham. And of course, one of the committee's members, Auntie, had an anaphylactic shock as a result of shellfish.
Right.
So we had to consider that.
Of course, yes. These are the external actors that get thrown into a stable system. Yeah, I'm familiar with that, yeah.
Right. So it must feel good.
It does.
To be called a novelist.
Yeah, absolutely. There's a part of me, because I was writing non-fiction books, but when you write a novel, suddenly now you enter, you've left another school, you're in a new school now, right, and everybody else is a few years ahead. You know, you're trying to go up to honours maths.
Yes.
Yeah. And people are kind of looking at you going, who's your man here now? And you feel like you're there in your short trousers.
And was it something you always aspired to, dreamt about?
I wasn't, I used to write the odd essay back in the day, but then I went off and did civil engineering in college and went off working in computers, the generic computers industry, for a few years. And then I quit to become comedian and gradually drifted back towards it, because comedian is kind of like doing a, it's you know, the skills you learn as a comedian can transfer in other directions. So it's almost like getting your undergraduate.
Oh, yes. It's a base skill.
Yes. To be able to talk and remember things while you're talking and listen when appropriate, in order to see, catch people, how they talk, what their cadence is, the language they use, even describe, you know, people's expressions, all that kind of stuff. So gradually drifted back, I think, perhaps to something that I was always going to do.
Okay, which is all very interesting, but it's taken us away from our job in hand, which is your soundtrack to your life.
It's a bit like a committee meeting there, where
who wants to be here and who has somewhere else to go. Now, you were born to Patrick and Eileen in 1978.
That's right.
Where were you born?
Dripsy.
Were you actually born in
Dripsy? No, I was born in, I get this wrong now, I think I was born in St Finbarr's Hospital in Cork. Right. And I think my mother drove herself in to have me, because she wanted to have my brother's confirmation. She wanted to hang on until the confirmation had been done, right, and then she went in herself on maybe May 1st, 1978, and I was born on May 2nd.
Do I take it then that your dad wasn't at the...
Milking. He was on the farm. Right. You know, it was equal. It was different. They specialise in different areas. Yeah.
Right. So, small farm, what type of farm?
Small farm,
it?
Yeah, 40 acres on the kind of a mixture of, furs, bushes and grass, really. Yeah. And there's not many of those farms left now. The small farm that I suppose often is usually might be swallowed up by other farms since, but we had cows and we had pigs, and it was the kind of farm where the pigs would go off wandering with the cows. And I think at one point the pigs escaped up the road. You know, like anybody who's ever grown up on a farm dreads the knock on the door where it's somebody telling you where your cows are, because you end up kind of going in this quest,
yes,
up the valley to find them. Because we had a little bit of river along one field, and the cows would often use that river to go. It was like into the heart of darkness, upriver.
Right,
into
is that the Lee?
It's the River Dripsy, which is a tributary of the River Lee.
Right, okay.
And you go up the river to find the cows.
And is that described as mid-Cork or...?
Mid-Cork.
Mid-Cork.
Yeah. We are... because it's almost defined by not being West Cork. Because whenever I say yes, I'm from Cork, everybody starts talking about how they have a house in Glandore.
Do they? Oh, yeah. Look at you, fancy. Yeah,
in order to... You need to see the people you want to be, you know. So when I say, no, it's mid-Cork, which is different. The West Cork has the, you know, the German ex-industrialist who's now sells like hemp.
All right. At a Saturday farmer's market.
At a farmer's market. Yeah. He speaks fluent Irish and he was in a film with Jeremy Irons. Like that's the classic West Cork person, you know, who's a farmer, a fisherman, a computer programmer, has a band, and is also in a film, whereas we'd be more prosaic, but we have our own kind of divilment as well. So we're under the radar in mid-Cork.
Yeah, mid-Cork. So your first memory, was it a sound? Was it a sound from the farm, or what?
Well, I think it's probably when Gay Byrne used to have the radio show, was because I was at home, so the, yeah. you know, most people didn't go to play school back in the day, particularly if you had a farm to wander around, and so you'd be like, I'd be at home from, you know, 2, 3, and listening to this would be the first sound in the morning.
There you are now. No, it's this should be the theme tune to this slot because yeah. so many people have memories of that tune. Yeah, Tico's tune.
Is that what it is?
Tico's tune. Yeah.
And it, I guess it started. It starts the day, and also it's almost a kind of a echo of this pre-school time before the day was defined by timetables and a bus arriving to collect you and more rigid. Form of day, so this is like almost a primeval memory of when we ran barefoot through the meadows before the man shackled us to the industrial machine, I think, or maybe just it was just the show I heard in the morning.
And were your big radio people? That's 1978. Yeah, I suppose
we would have been. Yeah, there we would have had we had radios that had the cities in Europe. That, you know, the various locations scattered yes. across Europe and Athlone, maybe Athlone and Luxembourg and, you know, Moravia or whatever. It's curious to think about that you would define position on the radio by location, but it made perfect sense. And I used to fall asleep at night listening to the news on BBC Radio 4. So seeping into my brain.
And now you work for the BBC World Service. Do you still work for them?
I still do a bit for them, yeah.
Right,
they give me a call there the odd time. And I've been in that house, the original one. So if you go to the BBC, you'll see there's a particular World Service. There's an entire floor. There might be the Africa floor, and it's BBC Hausa, BBC Great Lakes, BBC Egypt. Right. Signs up above people's desks. And it's quite... evocative when you remember, you know, because the World Service
come
on
those,
after
yes,
Radio
yes,
4
yeah.
and you wake up in the middle of the night to some, you know, drama somewhere in the world, but it was, you know, the little earphone under the pillow kind of seeping up through you. So I remember, like, 1989, I remember the first bit of the Iron Wall, or the Iron Curtain coming down.
Yeah, we have a bit of that there.
Well, the Hungarians are really caught between the devil and the deep blue sea here. They don't know what to do in... legalistic terms, they're bound by a treaty with East Germany dating back to 1969, by which the Hungarians have committed themselves not to allow East Germans out into the West through their borders. On the other hand, they've now signed the UN Convention on Human Rights, which theoretically should invalidate that treaty with East Germany. They are only a third party. They're not instigating the whole thing.
That was Misha Dleny of the BBC World Service, talking about the crisis in Hungary as East German refugees prepare to travel into Austria and Germany.
Yeah, and it was...
You were only 11.
Yeah, but I think everybody got caught up in it, you know, because at that time it was like, oh, the world's finally filling in, you know, things are getting good. I mean, we don't have that sense now, but
no.
between, say, 1989 and... 1999, before like the Millennium Bug started getting us all weird again, but there was this sense that the world was travelling in one direction,
yeah.
And you had books like The End of History, and the idea that we were reaching our potential, when in fact we were so deluded, because history goes in cycles and bad things happen and good things happen, but back then, you know, particularly you start learning history in school and you go, well, there was a First World War, we beat the bad guys in that. And there was a Second World War, we beat the bad guys in that. And look at this, now we're beating the last
yes.
bad guys
Communism,
from the movies. And it was so simplistic.
Yeah.
And we realise now that there was far more complex stories at hand and all of that. But that time was this period of like a movie. And if you heard the start of it, and there was a succession of good things happening. But at the same time, there was probably things underlying that laid seed, laid foundation for something else.
Were you a deep thinker as a child?
I'm trying to think about that. I definitely was earnest.
Right.
And you know the way when you're about 11 or 12, I always think when you're 11 or 12 before teenage years hit, you're at your peak. Like, that's the age, 7 to 12, where you start doing ridiculous projects that children do, boys and girls, like collecting or deciding. You know, my brother decided to write a history of the world in pencil, you know, and he just kept, you know, it's the kind, like, you have so much time.
Yeah.
You're pretty much as smart as you're ever going to be, really. Like, I don't think I'm any smarter now. And you have a sense that this is before you go to secondary school and get reset back, but you're top dog in school. And so you can be quite earnest. And I remember being like obsessed with the Amazon rainforest and preaching to people about deforestation without actually, you know, saying use recyclable paper. I was just telling people to stop, you know, telling my aunt, just, you know, we should need to do something about the Amazon. And she'd be like, oh, I suppose we do. let me see what my schedule is like. It's good to be earnest as well. I think because when you think of how cynical you can get later on, it's nice to remember a time when you were totally, sometimes annoyingly.
Yeah, people say it as a negative. You know, he's very earnest. I think it should be seen as a positive.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I think we're conditioned. I think we protect ourselves by not getting too earnest about something, protecting ourselves against disappointment. But there's nothing like believing in a thing and going for it.
Yeah,
you know.
Yeah. We have a montage of music from your sort of childhood, teenage years.
Yeah.
So when you're about to save the Amazonian rainforest, you're probably listening to these tunes. There you go. So, Culture Club, Karma Chameleon, Bob Dylan's Tangled Up in Blue, and When I'm 64 by the Beatles. Eclectic enough there.
Eclectic enough, and not necessarily matching the time in which I grew up in. So, Karma Chameleon was the first song I remember kind of singing on the school bus, having heard it on Top of the Pops or the radio, except I used to think it was Comedian, and because I didn't know what a chameleon was. And then the Bob Dylan one was I remember that, listening to that on a tape recorder the size of the computer that holds all the world's information now, and an old, you know, playing an old TDK-90 with a one-ear earphone, and under the pillow, and listening to that, and again trying to listen to it phonetically and figure out some of the lyrics and some of the references and getting them completely wrong. And the final one was a song, When I'm 64 by the Beatles. My mother taught me that, and I used to sing it as a party piece back to her. But as I was listening to them in preparation for this, I was thinking about the time when you had no idea what the lyric really was. It was written nowhere. It wasn't written, mostly wasn't written on album covers.
Very few album covers. You couldn't just Google it and get it there. Yes, you had to figure it out by listening.
Yeah,
yes.
So now it's the rest of your life is a process of filling in the things you thought you knew. Particularly like hip-hop. I remember like singing hip-hop phonetically, like with just no, and then realising, oh, that was pretty X-rated what I was thinking.
Yes.
There. And because there's a whole website now, genius.com, where it fills in all those lyrics and also tells you the meaning behind them. And it just reminds me of a time when we just were happy to not know something and move on.
Yeah.
Whereas now the knowledge that all knowledge is accessible makes you have to go and find it out.
Yes.
Because you're going to find something else you don't know. So it's we used to be happier not knowing things before.
Yeah, and you've a child.
Yeah, two now. Yeah.
Two children. Yes, and there'll come a time they're not of the asking age yet, are they?
Of the
asking big questions. You know, there was a time.
Oh well, we're at with the eldest where she's aware of the finality of life already.
What age is she?
Three and a bit.
And she's death.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and we're choosing a foreign word. She's pretty good at it. The best answer is to be honest, and they just accept it and move on. Because she'll be pointing at photos of people who aren't
your dad,
life,
for example.
Exactly. Yeah. And is able to deal. You know, is able to think of them as being in the photo and gone to live in our memories and all that kind of thing. And so it actually the more upfront you are at the start, the easier it is to build other more, even more difficult concepts
yes.
on top of that. But it's funny, she loaded a CD in by herself the other day. So she climbed up, shouldn't have been up that high, but climbed up, put the CD in. And I was watching her put the CD in and it was like as if I was watching her whittle or weave. Look, I was going, oh, it'd be great to see the old skills still there. Now look at her loading the CD, not bothering her like as if she was changing the wheel on a tractor. You're just delighted to see that knowledge that's been passed down from generation to generation hasn't been lost, and she's not swiping or shouting at WhatsApp or telling Siri, giving out to Siri.
Yeah, or Alexa, yeah. We're talking to Colm O'Regan. He's guiding us through the soundtrack to his life. We'll take a quick commercial break and we'll talk to Colm more after that.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Now, we got a lot of commonality because people come in, they're a certain age and they have the same memories, they're brought up in the same country. Yeah. So Bosco, for example, and 40 Coats and Wanderley Wagon and Gayborn, they all... come
yes,
up again and
again. I'm so basic.
But this is a new one.
Right.
And I was a big fan of this, so we're going to play this and we might be going back in time to when you were younger, because
sure.
you skipped on to your teenage years. So tell us about this.
This is it's Foghorn Leghorn. Yeah, I'm a huge fan of the Warner Brothers cartoons because they used to combine, slapstick with then highbrow stuff that was just hidden in there. And Foghorn Leghorn was one of my favourites because he was the put-upon hero who always kind of suffered, but you ended up kind of rooting for him. Like, less so, like, Wile E. Coyote was more, I thought, pathetic. Or there was no, we didn't really connect with Wile E. Coyote because he never got to say anything. And also, the Roadrunner was a bit of a... you know, just didn't like him. You know, he's a smart arse. Yeah. Whereas there was more heart in Foghorn Leghorn. And like, there's bits in Foghorn Leghorn where he's playing with he's minding the egghead, the little chick. And I think, if I remember correctly, he's trying to impress Egghead's mother. Like, that's the point. He's babysitting the small chick. And he plays hide and seek with the little chick. And so he sees the little chick hiding, goes off to hide behind like something. And, or no, he hides. So Foghorn Leghorn hides behind a tree. He sees a little chick going off search, doing his sums. The little chick was using maths to find out where Foghorn Leghorn was. And he'd get a shovel and dig up somewhere else. And then Foghorn Leghorn would say, "I say, this boy is rightly off track here." And then the chick would find him in the other place.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was just, apparently it's like a quantum mechanics joke right. hidden inside the cartoon.
That, right. And you say, "I say, boy."
That's him, yeah.
So we have a bit of Foghorn Leghorn here.
Let's bury the hatchet, but not in anyone's head, boy. But hatchet, head. But that's a joke, boy. You missed it. Went right past you. You gotta keep on your toes. But toes, that is. But the fast ones get right by you. Keep your ears open. But yappity, yappity, yep. I can't get a word in edgeways. Talk, talk, talk. But no wonder you're not sharp. You got a hose. I say you got a hose. Shut up.
Yeah, you see, you can't say that anymore, you know. But it was, it's funny when you look at old cartoons, they all look slightly matte and not as colourful because cartoons are so garish.
Yeah.
The colours are so vibrant and actually it was easier to watch before. They weren't as almost stroby
yes.
as they are now, and they stand.
They're an assault on your senses. Particular eyesight.
Yeah. Yeah. Cartoons these days, Ray. I don't know about the young people, all of the Warner Brothers characters, the references, the movies they used to. So in a way, any parody is in itself a little archive of the thing it's parodying. So when you watch Warner Brothers cartoons, you'll see references and then look them up and that'll give you another leap back in time to early Hollywood and all that kind of stuff. It's great.
Yeah. But if you analyse, it's like analysing comedy.
Yeah, I'm sure I'm 40. I'm in analyse heaven now. And plus, I'm willing to expound upon it in detail to anyone who wants to.
Who were your comedy heroes then? Because you said you went into engineering and then you went into computers. And was that a niche you had to scratch?
Yeah,
the comedy
was this
one.
Performing kind of, I don't know. I think I don't know what anyone else has the experience of making life-changing decisions on hungover Sundays, where I had a particularly crap night out on the Saturday night before, and I said, you know what, I've been meaning to do this now. I'm going to Google Open Mic Dublin and see what's available.
What was the lead-up to that hungover Sunday morning?
Drink. I always had, like, I used to do debating in school and that kind of thing, but I knew I was sort of funny enough Do you know what? Some people tell a story. They'll say, this is the funniest thing ever. Now, wait till you hear this, right? Wait till you hear this, right? Yeah. Anyway, so, oh, no, wait, no, hang on. No, let me start at the start. And then they've killed it. Whereas I used to find when I was telling a story to people, not performing stand-up, but just telling them, I'd say, well, here's what happened. And then build it up and then hit them with the punchline. And the rhythm seemed to... it seemed to come naturally to me. You know, it doesn't mean that the joke's funny. It just means that the structure was
funny. You should say that, right? Because Bernadette has been on to 51551. She says, enjoying Colm so much sounds like a natural comedian, which I love. Hope to see him in a show sometime. Thanks, Bernadette.
Thanks, there. Bernadette. Yeah, yeah.
She spotted that talent in you.
She did indeed. Yeah, yeah. She could be onto something there. Yeah, I could be one to watch. Yeah. Thanks very much, Bernadette.
And because you were saying to Neil that you do about 15 things now.
Yeah.
So you write, you're a broadcaster. We'll talk about the documentary coming up in a moment.
Yeah.
You stand up.
Stand up. We IMC a storytelling night once a month in the Sugar Club called Dublin Story Slam, which I love because it's people telling true stories about themselves. And some of the stories are incredible. And they have coincidences in them or twists that could only happen in true life. You know, sometimes a coincidence in a piece of fiction can kind of seem to fall into place and is only assemblable from the plot you've been exposed to before. But in a true story, something hits you out of nowhere. And often it's underwhelmed. It's not what you were expecting because you were expecting a Hollywood twist.
Yeah.
This is even better because it's so much more.
Is there a time limit?
Yeah, between 4 and 7 minutes.
Okay, right.
And what's great is that as somebody who writes fiction, the way true stories go allows you to say, right, well, nothing is implausible, if you know what I mean, because of what I've listened to what they do.
It's that whole adage, fact of strange and fiction.
Exactly. And the people, what's also great is people mightn't have ever told a story before. They mightn't have stood up in front of anyone before. And the audience welcomes them in because the audience is up for the story. They're not expecting stand-up. They're not expecting theatre. They're not expecting declamatory poetry. They're not expecting a reading. They're expecting a person just like them to tell a story.
Yeah.
And then they say to themselves, I didn't think I had a story, but that reminds me of the time. Because we all have at least one, you know, and it's as I say, it's one of my favourite jobs. And so other things I do, I write a column for The Examiner, which I find is a great way of marshalling the ad hoc thoughts I might have during the week into just something. It's a deadline. I'm extremely creative coming up to a deadline, I find, and I need a boss.
Isn't everybody?
I have 15 jobs because I want 15 bosses.
Yeah, okay, right.
I may have quit a job for that I was doing for years, but one of the things I loved about it was somebody telling me what to do.
Colm is brilliant. He's bringing back a lot of memories. I grew up in a 40-acre small farm in Kerry, says Pat in Cork. I was reared on a small farm myself. Cows, calves, a few sheep, horse, a few pigs, hens, ducks, turkeys, spuds, cabbage, carrots, onions, sprouts, etc. And the word organic wasn't even heard of, says Tom. And does Colm have a brother called Billy? I used to work with a Billy O'Regan from Dripsy.
No, I don't.
You're the youngest of four.
Youngest of four, yeah. I don't know, to the best of my knowledge, there's no brothers called Billy. But
okay.
He could be younger than me now. you kind of think you still have a claim in a place, but I'm getting on. So there might be new O'Regans in without my permission.
You're taking part in the Mountains to See Book Festival on Sunday, 31st of March, which is Mother's Day.
Mother's Day,
with Maya Dunphy.
That's right.
And the documentary I mentioned there. His Radio 1 is starting on April 24th.
I think it's actually, might be even this, is it May, or is it March 24th? It might even be this.
Well, what is it this Sunday?
Well, it's called Six Dads anyway.
Yes.
They can, we interview six fathers about the first year of their first child.
You're probably right, because this Sunday is the 24th.
Yeah.
And if it is, then April the 24th is not Sunday.
Let me do the 30 days.
It won't be. So we're saying then it's this Sunday and it starts, and it's you with six dads.
Six dads. So we interview them, and there's some great stories about being first-time father and the first year and what happens in the lead-up to it and after the birth.
So you're presenting it and sharing your stories,
exactly,
I imagine, as well.
Yeah.
Listen, great to see you.
Thank you.
And thanks for Foghorn, Leghorn and everything else. Colm O'Regan, thank you. And the new book is Anne Devine, Ready for Her Close-Up, which is in good bookshops, well, all bookshops now. Thanks, Colm. 51551, ray@rte.ie. And good luck to Mick McCarthy and the Republic of Ireland football team in Gibraltar tomorrow. We had Mick McCarthy on the soundtrack to his life last week. And if you didn't listen to it, you can listen back on the RTE website. Mick Flannery joins us in studio. You're a neighbour of Colm O'Regan's.
Well, Gypsy would be about less than five miles away from Blarney. But I've never met him before.
So Blarney would be the nearest town, I suppose, to Gypsy.
Coachford would be nearer to
it. Yeah. Yeah. Did you ever go to the discos in Coachford Hall?
Yeah, I used to
DJ there.
Did you?
Yeah.
What years?
I don't know. It would have been the 90s when I was on the Den. The big song at the time would have been House of Pain, Jump Around.
Yeah, I would have been there.
You would have been there. You probably didn't know it was me.
We used to have a silly war between Blarney and Ballincollig at the Coachford Disco.
Right.
Nobody knew why it was happening. It's just
ridiculous.
I was chatting to this lad outside Coachford Disco once, and we were just getting along fine. Strangers. And at the end, he asked me, where was I from? And I said, Blarney. And he goes, I'll see you later, boy. Because he was from Ballincollig. It just made no sense.
Absolutely no sense.
Tribal warfare in Coachford.
No sense. Right, so you're bringing your debut album, Evening Train, to the stage.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, explain that to me.
Well, it's been kind of in the works for a while, but it's cool that it's happening. It was a concept album, and a screenwriter called Ursula Rani Sarma wrote a screenplay for it. So we've kind of just got it across the budget lines at the Everyman
in Cork. Theater.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's on from Thursday the 13th to Sunday the 23rd of June.
Yeah.
And everymancork.com, tickets priced from 25. And you're going to sing us a song from that, and you're joined by your aunt.
And yeah, this is Yvonne Daly.
Yvonne. You might even call his aunt. No.
His aunt.
Yeah. Because aunt is always older, isn't it? Sort of, your aunt.
Yeah, unfortunately it is too, but...
You are older, okay, yeah. Right. So you're going to sing Grace's Waltz?
Yeah.
Right, when you're ready.
Come on. Put your dancing shoes on. Piano is playing a tune. The lights are on. The night is young. And I wanna go waltzing with you. But these people got no sense of fun. Let's show these Joes how it's done.
Come on. You're drifting to some different song. You've too much wine. We're out of time. Though nothing about it feels wrong. I guess this is as close as I'll get. But I won't give up on you yet. So next time you need a partner, unless I go find.
That was lovely.
Thank you.
So what way is it going to work then? So they've taken the songs and weaved it into a...
story. Like, I had written a story line into the album sleeve, you know.
Right.
It's a kind of a love triangle story about these two brothers. And they're trying to get out of a small town scenario, but they're kind of caught in this romantic...
Triangle
thing, yeah. So it was kind of awkward. Like, myself and Yvonne would be doing these songs, like, and she'd be my romantic interest for the whole gig, like singing love songs to her.
Your aunt,
yeah.
Dare I ask, was it biographical, the song?
It's kind of, one of the brothers is a kind of a drinker and a gambler, and the other guy is kind of more straight-laced.
Yeah.
So it could have been a little bit of bipolarism. Like, I was trying to figure out which one I was.
Right, right. So it's Evening Train, the musical, and it's on the Everyman in Cork. It must be very exciting to see.
It's good crack.
Yeah.
The auditions and stuff is very strange to be a part of, you know, like looking at people doing their acting bits. And
Where do you come into it then?
Like, I have to see if they can sing or not.
I know, but are you going to be...
I'll be part of the band.
Oh, you'll be part of the band,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you'll sing as well, will you? No.
I'd say possibly, yeah, maybe one or... But I won't be, like, I won't be part the, of the... the I can't well, act, like.
Right.
I
mean, who says?
My repression.
Right. So, yeah, it's Thursday 13th, is Sunday 23rd of June in the Everyman in Cork. €25 tickets start at and everymancork.com. Mick Flannery, great to see you.
Thank you.
That sounded great, Yvonne. That sounded lovely. Thank you very much.
The Ray Darcy Show on RTE Radio 1.
Or 51551 for your text. Let's have a listen to a bit of this.
But it was not. And it was your heart on the line. I really f***ed it up this time. Deny my dear. Deny my.
Yes, indeedy. Mumford & Sons are coming to Ireland this summer. They'll play two dates at Malahide Castle in June. And Marcus Mumford, frontman, is on the line. Afternoon, Marcus.
How you doing?
Good to talk to you. It's hard to believe that
it's
10 years since that was a hit. Little Lion Man.
I know. Time flies, man.
Yeah.
Time flies.
What age were you when that was a hit?
I was 21.
Right. It's been a very exciting 10 years here. And you know that you have a very loyal constituency of fans here in Ireland, so they're delighted that you're coming to Malahide Castle. And you were big here from the start, weren't you?
Yeah, Ireland was pretty much the first country outside the UK to sort of embrace our band.
Mm.
It went Ireland, then Australia, and our tours in both countries have always, as a result, felt filled with people who've been with us from the start, but also like who shared their enthusiasm for our band with their mates along the way. And they've always just felt like really exciting shows. And so we're pretty grateful, to be honest. And so when we get to come back and play in Ireland, it always feels like a treat. So we don't say that everywhere we go.
You say that to all the countries.
Special, man, so. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hello, Norway. We do have a special. We do have a special kind of relationship with our Irish audience, and we just love it, man.
Yeah, and Dermot Kennedy and Wild Youth and Aurora are going to be supporting you, which is great. So, would you pick your support acts?
Oh yeah, we spend hours talking about it, and we always sort of pull whatever we've been listening to recently together, and we spend a lot of time sort of curating the lineups for our shows, and especially these the kind of more festival type ones that we call them Dent on the Road shows, which we sort of promote ourselves, and we spend normally it's like a good 2 hour conversation. And I tend to sit in the bath and put the phone on mute and pipe up whenever I feel like I've got something relevant to say.
Right.
Because the other lads have very strong opinions. And Ben, you know, has his own label and is constantly listening to new music. So he's always introducing us to stuff. And I tend to sort of sit in the back and just repeat the people I most want to see on our lineup.
well, like Dermot Kennedy and Wild Youth, two very exciting Irish talents at the moment, just really powerful stuff. Delta,
indeed.
Album number 4, straight in at number 1 in America again. That's the third album in a row. So that's so many bands over the years, and I suppose you were reading about them when you were a kid, you know, were very successful in the UK and Ireland, and then they couldn't break America. That was the big thing. They couldn't break America. But you did that, smashed it. How does that feel?
It feels like it just presents us with more work to do, to be honest. I don't really look back. I don't look at it and think like, oh, cool, we've done that now.
Right.
It basically just opens up. I remember our lawyer saying to us really early doors, like, if you don't focus on anything else for the first 5 years of your band, and you work really hard at touring everywhere you can, and the States especially, you can have a career for the rest of your lives, but you've got to focus and you've got to work really hard. And the truth is, in America, you can just go round and round and round. Like a lot of bands do. There are certain bands in the States, massive in the States, that don't really play anywhere else. Because you can just go round and round. It's massive. So I think it just means that we feel like we've got a lot to try and do. We're knocking off a couple states on this. We're in Nashville today. But we're knocking off a couple states on this tour that we've never played before. We're trying to get around all the states. I think we've got like 8 left or something. And then you just go around again. You can keep going. So the danger is that you tour America too much and don't get to go to the other parts of the world where you want to be.
Yeah.
So it's busy. It's busy. It just means there's a lot to do. But yeah, of course, it feels great, man.
Yeah. Thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. So Delta, somebody, Ben, who you mentioned already, described it as being about the 4 Ds: death, divorce, drugs, and depression.
There's a 50 there, which is disagreement, because I disagree with them quite strongly on that one.
Right.
And I told them so. That's a pretty depressing list, and yeah, we never really talked about that. No, it's also about birth and relationships, and mostly it's about people. So it's about wonderful things and some negative things
and
as
you're,
well.
You're,
but, I mean, we write songs autobiographically, so.
You're a dad. Where's another G? Sorry. Today's program's brought to you by the letter G.
Yeah.
So what's fatherhood like for you?
Yeah, mate. It's amazing. It's the best. Unbelievable. I'm loving it, honestly.
Yeah.
It's a real privilege.
Yeah. And does it change your... Well, I know this from my point of view, but it changes your outlook on life, doesn't it? Your view of the world.
Yeah, it does. And I think it changes your desires, which is kind of cool as well. I thought desires would always be something you just have to control and discipline yourself to change in some ways, but it has changed my desires. Like, I just want to be around them all the time. It's been wicked, man. It feels good.
You've a 2-week rule with your wife, Carrie, who works in the business as well. She's an actor. Explain the 2-week rule to us.
Mm. I don't know how you found out about that. You've got good researchers. we basically don't want to normalise distance, so we try and see each other, make sure, even when we're both working, we see each other every 2 weeks. And that's just sort of a small kind of rule that we put in place quite early on.
You're probably sick of talking about this, but you were spotted yawning at the royal wedding, Harry and Meghan's. Was it a tough night the night before? Or?
I got more text messages about that than when we headlined Glastonbury Festival. It wasn't. No. I mean, I said to my wife at the wedding, I said to her at one point, give us a snitch, babe. And she was like, no, there's cameras everywhere. And I said, no one's going to be looking at us. Elton John's over there. George Clooney's over there. You know, no one's going to give a shit about us. And then, of course, cut to me having a cheeky yawn. Before the ceremony started, I think. We've been in there for a couple of hours. It was a hot day, and I was knackered.
Right, so that's it. That's your story, and you're sticking to it. Of course, you're because the way the music business goes now, people are hanging around a lot longer, and they're, you know. So you are now like meeting people who were heroes of yours, people that you would have listened to as a kid. Like I'm thinking about, Bruce Springsteen. Like you're meeting a real, live legend. Like, what goes through your head when that happens?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, a lot. Most of the time we tend to see people play and then we might meet them. So I still have, like, a pretty strong emotional reaction seeing some of those old Bruce Springsteen songs that I listened to with my dad in the car, because it was, like, one of the only CDs that survived the family car for years. And I saw his show on Broadway. And hearing him sing like Tougher Than the Rest in my hometown. It's a massive, massive deal. And actually, I didn't want to try and see him after that show because, A, I thought he'd be knackered, but B, I just wanted to leave it there as a sort of crystalline piece of beauty that I always remember. But yeah, when we played with him before and he's been very kind about our band and to our band. And I don't ever want to stop being starstruck, Like, he's one of my all-time heroes. And he likes our band. Like, that's all I need. That's massive. But I also don't want to ever take it for granted, you know. But then you also think, like, these are just dudes who make music like anyone else, and there's an element to which there's nothing really special.
Yes, that's
like about their humanity above and beyond anyone else's.
Yes.
So I actually really, I've really enjoyed, especially on this tour. I think our band went through a period of time where we got a bit shy. After Babel and in Wild of Mind, we sort of were a bit knackered and we're a bit burnt out, and we're quite tired of like just meeting new people every day and got a bit burnt out. So we went away for a bit, and then we came back for Delta, realizing like that's one of the complete privileges of our job, like getting to congregate and hang out with people and meet different people. And so we kind of thrown ourselves at it a bit more on this run, and it's honestly been more fulfilling in that way, because the show's really all about people, and you know, we watch the support bands every night, and we get to hang out with them a bit, we get to meet new people in each city we go to, and you know, the kind of people, the extraordinary people you can meet in Albany, New York, or Birmingham, Alabama, or like Adelaide, Australia. It's like you don't want to waste those opportunities.
No.
With touring, one of the great things about touring is that you get to travel and meet people. We're enjoying it, yeah.
And while you were writing songs for Delta, the current album, you bumped into Noel Gallagher, and you were having a bit of a writer's block, were you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. And he told me to pull my finger out, basically.
Probably not as polite as that, even.
No, it wasn't. There was a lot of swear words. I don't know what I'm allowed to say.
No, it's the afternoon.
There's a lot of swearing.
Yeah.
There's a lot of swearing and sort of saying, like, what are you doing with your life if you're not writing songs? You're a songwriter. Go away and just write some songs. Stop whinging about it, in his classic Noel Gallagher way. And he's been both kind and slagged our band off in the past. And I don't think you're a real band till you've been slagged off by Gallagher. He also once said he wished he'd written The Cave.
Ah.
And I said to him privately once, I'll swap you Wonderwall for it.
What did he say to that?
Which he denied. He said no. He sort of said, like, just get on with it. What else are you going to do with your life? And I've heard him talk in the past about like having to hold his hands out, waiting for songs to drop like manna from heaven. And if he doesn't hold his hands out, Chris Martin or Bono are going to catch the songs, you know.
Yeah.
Which I think is a cool analogy. So, yeah, he was actually really motivated. It was really sweet. He was really motivated. I went away and the next day wrote a couple of songs for this record. So, yeah, it was good.
It worked. So, Mumford & Sons are playing Malahide Castle on Friday, which is sold out, and tickets are on sale for June 15th. They're on sale now. And support Aurora, Dermot Kennedy and Wild Youth. Marcus, thanks so much for taking time out to talk to us today. Great talking to you.
No worries, thanks so much.
Okay, that's Marcus Mumford there from Mumford & Sons, and Delta is their current CD, album, etc., and they're coming to Malahide Castle. Just a reminder about the show tomorrow night on the telly. We have Joanna Reardon, we've PJ Gallagher, we've Aidan Gillen and Camilla Sullivan singing a song. We've Anne Hegarty, the governess from The Chase. And we have Stephen Travers, who'll be talking to us about the new documentary on the Miami show band massacre. That's all tomorrow night at 20 past 10 on RT1. That's it from us on the radio. If you're not tuned into telly, have a good weekend, and we'll talk to you on the radio again 3 o'clock on Monday. Katie Hannon is on the way with Drive Time.